dear listeners. Kyla here, popping in to introduce an episode of Green Majority Radio, a podcast and radio broadcast that we've worked with a couple of times. This particular episode features yours truly and my lovely co-host, Kristen Pugh, discussing our latest project, Climate Justice Organizing Shorts. We really enjoy Green Majority Radio, and we thought that if you haven't had a chance to listen to an episode of theirs yet, you might as well. So buckle up and enjoy Friend of the Pod, Green Majority Radio.
You know, sometimes people can be paralyzed by the fear of making a mistake, and sometimes you just have to get in there and try, and the effort is what matters.
You have this like less than 1% of musicians who are doing incredibly well and like becoming billionaires, right, from touring. And then you have the rest of the 99% of musicians who are struggling to make ends meet. And the only ones who can kind of sustain themselves are ones who come from incredible wealth or like families with huge connections in the entertainment industries.
Welcome to the Green Majority. This is my throat on the way to the grave and Green Majority. Best of March 2024. We have David Hostetter, we have Stefan Hostetter, we have Lauren Latour. Canada's oldest environmental radio show, the hell of the burgeoning world, just continually sprying up at us in these spumes, these flumes, and these twisting, malevolent floral enterprises of sensation.
Wow.
One is addicted to sensation. One has an experience which is good, and one thinks one would like to have more good experiences.
I mean, I think it's hard to deny that.
So one does one's best at isolating the factors that led to the good experience and repeating those in a repetitive pattern, developing a habit of clinging to structures that are supposed to yield further pleasure.
Well, I mean,
that's addiction. Stefan's addicted. I'm addicted. You, listener, are addicted. We are on CIUT 89.5 FM. Or your local community radio station or your podcast application, Harbinger Media Network. I have taken two weed gummies and and Stefan has betrayed me.
I have betrayed
and,
you.
And abandoned me. He has essentially cut off my genitalia and left me writhing in the street.
I am the one here trying to bring this all together, and I'm being accused of abandonment.
Bringing this all together? As if I were to have created a shambles for you to then nail together with a crude hammer.
You apparently did just take two weed gummies, so.
Well, I don't know what kind of weed gummies you take. But I take normal weed gummies.
All right.
Stefan looks like a velociraptor.
All right.
Okay, and now we are turning to Stefan and Lauren talking about two large omnibus bills recently introduced by Mr. Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario.
No, like if you see a conservative with an omnibus bill, run the other direction. It's the worst thing in the world. And it's so funny because this is not just a Canadian conservative tactic. This is bad. I was talking to some international colleagues last week. Cannot remember where they were from. It could have been Brazil. It could have been Norway. It could have been anywhere. And they were saying that their conservative government was doing the same thing, introducing like sweeping legislation to like slash regulation across the board and calling it an omnibus budget bill. And I was like, oh my gosh, we do that. It's everywhere.
They love the big bills. They're all about them because this act would A, make it easier to expropriate land for highways and transit projects before environmental approvals. It would Any future government would have to put on a referendum before instituting a carbon price, which I'll get to, which is also silly and wrong. But anyways, the third thing it would do is it once again alters municipal growth plans for like the fifth time in the last like 2 years. Like it keeps changing. I cannot imagine how it must feel to be a municipal planner right now, who just constantly has the rules changed under them every again and again. And an additional Star article that came out, I believe, a couple days after this bill came out, highlighted that some of these more technical changes that are hard to sort of parse out will very likely worsen sprawl. And then lastly, it just continues to like make things cheaper for drivers for some reason by basically making you never have to pay the $7 that would make sure that you renew your car, which also helps get it back when it's stolen. But who cares? Let's just allow that to continue, and also makes no new highways have tolls on them, which is, again, no current plans that were there to toll highways, but that's a thing.
So sorry, that's just referring to no new toll highways,
yeah.
Or they're removing toll. Oh, so it's not okay, because I'm not gonna lie, there was like the lizard brain part of me was like, sick, I can take the 407 now.
And what's amazing is that
for listeners from outside of Ontario, the 407 is a toll highway that's quite expensive, that stretches and kind of allows you to circumnavigate the GTA if you're cutting across southwestern Ontario. I never take it because I'm not made of money. And part of me was like, oh, wait, that's kind of sick.
Well, arguments against the 413, which is what this whole bill is basically trying to make it easier for him to pass this other highway, which is the 413 and the Bradford Bypass. And some of the arguments against these things is that if you just let trucks freely drive on the 407, you would solve all of the problems you're trying to solve. What's confusing about this whole issue is that like selling public goods to a private company that can make money for 99 years, which they did with the Highway 407, is not like a liberal ethos, right? Like this was straight up done as an offload costs and a money grab from a previous conservative government. And so this idea that now he's taken on tolls as the way to make it cheaper for driving is also sort of weird. There's a second bill, but maybe let's go bill by bill. So let's start there.
Well, I don't know. Like this second bill is like pretty cuckoo to me, especially if you're considering it's like, I don't know. Again, I understand the twisted logic at play here in terms of just like where they're going with this and the ways in which it propels businesses and like cuts red tape. But this second bill is just like, I don't know. To me, I would be furious if I were a small C conservative, because I'd be thinking, well, this limits the rights of the individual landowner. I can't see how this is something they could possibly support. And yet they'll spin it to be about business. So I don't know. Can you just brief us a little bit on the second bill as well? And we just combine the combo.
For sure. So my understanding, and correct me if I am wrong about this, is that basically the Ontario Energy Board, which is supposed to be an arm's length part of the government, that it was going to require real estate developers to pay for the costs of new gas infrastructure up front, rather than spreading out the costs by charging customers over 40 years. Part of the idea here is that if they can spread it out, that makes it more likely that they will build these more now. And we don't, you know, do we want to be locking ourselves into the gas infrastructure for the next 40 years? And that's an upfront cost to the government right away, that the government's basically floating to these business owners. And the new bill basically undoes that. The new bill basically overrides this regulator, claiming that it will keep the costs of home ownership down, which is quite a take, but that's the argument. And basically sort of like gets rid of the idea that the OEB is an arm's length agency. It basically makes it just another wing of the conservative government, which, you know, I mean, goes along with, I think last week or the week before, Doug Ford also basically defended his very political appointees to the board that chooses our Supreme Court judges by basically saying, well, what else was I going to do? Elect a liberal? I'm a conservative. Which is like, so you're just sort of seeing this pattern of making everything political and everything sort of aligned with your own view, even in these agencies that are very much designed to not be political. He's politicizing everything and using and sort of this like, well, what am I supposed to do argument?
Well, yeah. And like with this one specifically with the OEB, the Ontario Energy Board, they were saying like, okay, well, like we're giving them time. They're going to go back and they're going to revisit their regulatory proposal that, again, was drafted over years, from what I understand, with lots of input. And they're like, we're going to let them go back to it. But like, we're not ruling out stopping it again, basically, if they don't give us the regulation that we want, if they don't change things accordingly. No, these two bills between overriding the OEB and like, yes, OK, sure, you're slashing red tape. You're making it easier for a company to come in and get it done. But like at the expense of the homeowner, at the expense of, not that I'm out defending homeowners all the time, but like at the defense of the individual, which is, I don't know, supposed to be something that you're in defense of. And then on the flip side, you've got this other act. Oh, wait, I mixed up the names of the act. Sorry. That's the Keeping Energy Costs Down Act that we were just referencing with the OEB. The Get It Done Act has this, okay, this issue of expropriating, which is a word that I had heard before, but I wasn't super familiar with. And I'm really glad this article kind of broke it down for us. And basically, expropriation is the idea that a landowner will be forced to sell their parcel of land to the government. And previously, there were like obviously like hearings that were put in place automatically when the issue of expropriation came up. If the government were trying to force me to sell some of my land so they could put a highway through it, those hearings were done away with in 2020 under the Ford government. And now they're continuing to make it easier to expropriate land in order to get these highways built. And it's like, I'm sorry. Are you kidding me? What conservative is down with expropriation of land, of you forcing them to sell you their land, regardless of whether it's for a highway or a wind turbine? You know what I mean? Maybe I would care less about this if it were wind turbines. Maybe I would. Maybe I'm a hypocrite. But regardless, it's just like, I don't know. Come on, guys. Like, this is wild. And also, then the other thing was, it's just like, why am I reading about this in the Narwhal and on the National Observer? How is this not like banner news? Maybe it is. Maybe my millennial ass just needs to, like, I don't know, turn on cable every so often. But cuckoo banana stuff happening under the Conservative government of Ontario.
Yeah, for sure. And it just, to me, goes back to the exact type of things that the constituencies that Doug Ford cannot get enough of. And like, there is nothing the Doug Ford government likes more than trying to lock you into driving your car. It is amazing how addled with car brain Doug Ford in this government is. Almost 80% of the things they do seem to be based around the attempt to either make you drive more because it's now cheaper, or because you don't have to renew your license plates anymore, or because they're going to build three more highways, or because the changes to their housing plans just increases sprawl. Like, every single one of these things, the number one outcome will be Ontarians spend more time in their vehicles. And like, that to me is a terrible vision for the future. No one is happy driving through traffic, and all we're doing is guaranteeing ourselves more traffic in 16 different ways with these plans. You know, and the carbon price thing, that's just conservative showboating and going along with a sort of axe the tax thing that Poilievre is doing, because like, the next government doesn't actually have to do this. If the next government wanted to bring in a price on carbon, they can just repeal this law and then bring in a price on carbon. There's absolutely no way this will be effective. And we all may be aware, because of how much Poilievre and the Conservatives won't shut up about it, we currently have a price on carbon right now that was instituted by the feds legally without any of these things. And you wouldn't have to do it again even if it happened a second time. Like, literally nothing he is doing on that whole file is anything beyond prancing up and down saying, I did something. Because like, it's not actually that much harder at all to institute another price on carbon if they wanted to. He just wanted to say he did something.
No, exactly. Sorry, I just check dates, and my theory is falling apart based on the dates, because we don't have another provincial election until 2026. But at first my instinct was, oh my God, Harper pulled out the omnibus bills like a year or two before the election. And it's a way of like ramming through as much change and as much like deregulation and policy alteration as possible, because it's like, it's right before an election. They want to get as much, I think of it in negative terms, they want to do as much damage as possible. But also on the flip side, they want to be able to, like, again, like you said, tout to their voters that like they're being effective administrators. But it doesn't quite work out. Harper's omnibus bills, I guess, rolled out in like 2014, 2013. Oh, well, you know what? 2014, 2013, election in 2015, rolling this stuff out in 2020. Anyway.
Yeah, so it's close.
Right?
I will say these bills are not as, I think, unbelievable as Harper's were.
No, they're like, not like Harper's like C-45. It was devastating.
Yeah. There was everything. It was truly like Harper, as much as maybe, you know, the Kennyism interview, we'll talk a little bit about Harper times, but like he just went for it. Like he was like, what if one bill that changed healthcare, the census, and environmental regulations and fishes? Why not? Just, whatever.
Just decimated everything.
And now we turn to Stefan speaking with the hosts of the Pullback podcast about their series with La Hub, Climate Justice Organizing Hub, about practical advice and information for climate activists.
So much out there that is theoretical, or that is talks about the, you know, ideas behind why we do what we do, and not nearly as much content is made to be like, no, here's how you do this thing. Like, you want to know how to make your meeting more accessible? These five things, you should do them. And at least that are sort of aimed at new groups starting up. You sort of get those types of conversations, like maybe from like these larger NGO type spaces where it's like, oh, here's the five tips you can do that, and become sort of a LinkedIn post. But it's not, doesn't really have the practicality so often of like, you need to do these things, or you're trying to figure out how to start something, or, you know, or make sure that something goes well, do this. Like, that practicality is really key.
Yeah. And I think our episode about disability justice in climate spaces was really good for that, for really bringing together the idea of why it's important and how smaller groups especially can forget or leave behind these sort of ideas, because the climate movement has a lot to do, right? Like, we're busy. We've got a lot going on. And it feels like these grand ideals that we're reaching for are so elevated and high that it's hard to focus on the small things, but you can't get to the top without taking those baby little ladder steps, right? And a big part of that is building a really strong foundation in your movement. And our episode on Indigenous solidarity and especially disability justice were, I found, really enlightening in the idea that people just need to even stop to think about it. A lot of people think, oh, we don't have time for that. We're too small. We don't have the space or the capacity. But you do. And it's actually easier than you think.
Yeah. And I think that was a really big point of the Indigenous solidarity episode, that, you know, sometimes people can be paralyzed by the fear of making a mistake. And sometimes you just have to get in there and try. And the effort is what matters. And that was also something we got from, we did a great episode on divestment with Jenna Jandal, who has basically single-handedly, no, she did it with other people, but kicked RBC off campus at her university. And she was really inspiring, I thought, because she had started from zero. She just picked a fight with RBC on campus. And so it really shows that like anybody really can get involved. And it's not as overwhelming as you might think.
Yeah, starting small is really important. And a lot of people, especially in the climate space or even outside of it, you know, everybody's feeling overwhelmed, everybody's tired, but it doesn't need to be as big as starting a banner drop with 40 people on a bridge downtown. You know, like, it can be as small as, I mean, just email your MP, guys. We talk about more than that. We are talking to people in the climate organizing space specifically who have already kind of started the work, but there is also a lot for listeners who are not there yet and are ready to get going. So I think we did a pretty good job of covering a breadth of experience, from very beginner to people who maybe are already in the space and just want, you know, some more content to listen to spark your imagination.
And imagination sparking is important. And so I'm curious, you've done a decent number of these episodes, a couple more to go, but is there anything that you've learned so far that you're like, oh, wow, this thing people should know about?
I found the de-escalation episode very fun, in that de-escalation for me is kind of scary because I'm just a little girl. and it's hard to kind of go to a space where you might have to be in confrontation with somebody
And so I think a lot of people stay away from climate protests because of that. But what we learned from Robbie in our de-escalation episode, who's a regular guest on our own show, Pullback, the number one thing that he told us to do, and I think I'm taking this not just for the climate movement, but in like on board for my own personal life, is just be calm. Like, show what you want to receive. If you want the other person to calm down, be calm yourself, right? And it really is that easy. And the other thing is, you know, everybody wants something. If you know what the other person wants, it's pretty easy to kind of level with them and get to that space. And also, most people are decent. And so, you know, if people do want to throw fists or whatever, it's not your job as a climate organizer to stop that. It's your job to keep other people safe. And I really appreciated that. I found he talked about marshalling at climate protests a lot, and I kind of want to be a marshal now. He really made it sound like a ton of fun, which is wild because de-escalation sounds so scary. But he made a really good point that, like, if you're just having a good time, like, counter-protesters will often just go home. Kristen, did you, what's your favorite thing that you learned?
I mean, I learned so many things, but I think the episode on disability justice with Daniel Serra, it just had so many practical tips that I hadn't thought about, and including that the most important thing you can do for accessibility at an actual protest is, like, information, which seems really obvious, but if you just provide information about what the barriers might potentially be, people can make choices for themselves. And it's just such a simple thing. Even organizations with not a lot of resources can take that step at the very least, right? Can't always make sure that, like, there's every single, like, you can't always pay for sign language interpreters and things like that. You can always provide the information about, like, what's going to be happening, when the end time's going to be, where the bathrooms are going to be. Everybody wants to know that. That's such a good piece of advice.
And the transparency makes people feel safer coming forward with their access needs, right? They're like, this is a space that might actually listen to me if I come up and I say that I need this access need. And so just providing information makes it easier for people to tell you what you might need to do if you aren't thinking about it.
So often when groups, new groups, and I've experienced this myself, come into play, you find yourself in this weird balance of you don't have any resources, so you feel like you can't do a lot of things, but then you feel an urgency to do stuff, so you end up doing as much as you can, which means that you don't actually give yourself the time to do the pre-planning. Like, all of what you're describing there is just more work, right? It's just more time. It's nothing else, right? Like, to tell people where the bathrooms are is not more money. It is literally just doing the work beforehand to think it through and be like, look at a map and be like, okay, well, here's the closest accessible washrooms to where we're going to do this thing, starting a month out instead of immediately. And I think that, like, we have this weird challenge, and I think this is more general to the climate movement and to our lives currently, which is that we have this drive and need to take action as fast as possible. And so we do that in a way that ends up being a bit more scattershot. Like, if we just accepted that, okay, I'm going to do this rally, but I'm going to do this rally in an extra month later, and to give myself just a ton of time to be able to do these other pieces, you'll end up with a more effective rally, maybe not at the exact moment you thought you wanted or whatever, or you had to start thinking about it earlier than you expected, but you can make up for a lack of resources with an investment of giving yourself the space and time and slowing yourself down. Like, it's amazing how much more you can do when you slow yourself down.
That was actually 100%. One of my favorite points that was made by Janelle Lapointe in our Indigenous Solidarity episodes, which is that the climate movement has this sense of urgency, which is fair. I mean, we're in a dive, but the climate is not going to be doing great for a long time. And we really owe it to ourselves to slow down. We owe it to ourselves and to the people that come after us to not be in a constant state of panic. And like, yes, it's urgent, fine, but it's not going anywhere. So everyone take a deep breath. And she really lent on her own Indigenous teachings to kind of talk about how you need to think about things in the long run. And if you're packing a bag for a trip, in a night is the analogy she used that was wonderful, then it feels awful. You're in a hurry and it feels rushed and you're going to forget stuff. You're going to forget stuff and you're going to have a bad time. So everyone just needs to breathe to like, this is going to take a lifetime. And that's okay, right? I love this work. And sometimes it can be kind of depressing, but one of the points that came up again and again and again in every single episode is everybody who's in this space and who's making an effort to make our world better feels like they have purpose and like they have something to be working towards. And I really appreciated that. And yeah, the point that you made is exactly right. Like the sense of urgency that we have that makes us kind of trip over our own feet to get to something. But why, right? Like it's, there's just going to be another thing after that. So everyone breathe.
Yeah. And I think like, as you mentioned, Kyla, this theme came up in a couple of different episodes. And I really liked in Daniel Serra's episode on disability justice, the point that like, if you do take that extra time and effort to make sure that the movement is inclusive, it actually makes for a much stronger movement in the long run because people can participate in the ways that they can. And because it's not a sprint, you need people to really be engaged in the best way that they can to contribute. So it's more effective also, in addition to feeling better.
That's something I think that is really hard to unlearn, I think, for those of us who are steeped not only in the urgency of the feeling of the moment, but also the urgency that is created by our sort of capitalist system to say produce, you know? And so the need to undo both of those things at the same time, because like one really feeds the other. You have this deep feeling of needing to produce because of sort of the internalized capitalism, the world we live in. And then you're told that there's like a very scary thing coming very soon. And you're like, ah, I do need to do a bunch of stuff because have you seen that? But, you know, as we've seen, the path towards change doesn't come from 150 very quickly thrown together rallies. Like that's not a successful path towards change. And so we have to find other ways, right?
Well, and one of my favorite things that we talked about with Montana Burgess in the deep canvassing episode is that the most, I think what I learned from that is one of the most effective ways to create change, especially at the local level, which is where change needs to be made. You can't change everything all at once. It's just to have conversations with people that last more than 5 minutes where you're not trying to sell them something, right? Like you're going to go door knocking. Be ready to ask curious questions and listen to people as they talk about their, like as they talk about these things that maybe they've just heard sound bites for, but they haven't actually had a chance to work through because we're all so busy living in our capitalist nightmare. That nobody has time to sit down and actually think about the things that Pierre Polyev or whoever is saying. And so they'll have a chance on the door with these deep canvassers to maybe think aloud for the first time and be like, wait a second, I don't actually agree with that. And conversations like that take time and they're slow, but they're really worth it because once you get somebody on side, that's somebody else in your movement. It's like a zombie apocalypse, right? Like the more people you can get in your horde.
Are we the zombies in this analogy?
Kristen, there's zombies in every analogy that I want to make. You're only lucky that I don't do it as often as I want.
Although I do like the idea that we are the zombies. Because they give us a way better chance, I think, honestly. Like in every zombie movie, the zombies are the ones that are slowly taking over versus the opposite, right? So like exactly. If we're the zombies, that's great. Great news for us.
Yeah. And it's just one little bite. It's one little bite and then you infect the person and then they're on your side. It's that easy. Just be a zombie.
They're also slow. The metaphor really works.
Now we turn to Stefan speaking with Kim Fry from Music Declares a Climate Emergency about how to support small artists and culture and how to make the music industry sustainable.
One of the big questions that I think comes up as I think through us moving towards a more sustainable world is, you know, what joy and celebration and, you know, fun looks like. Right? Because so much of what we currently do in society, or so much of what's currently pushed in society for these things are consumption-based, right? Yep. You know, they are go buy something, hang out in a shopping mall, you know, order stuff to your house and then do things. You know, like there's so much consumption that is based right now in our current ways of enjoyment. And that's shifted in some ways as, you know, things have moved online. But then, of course, then there's the energy draw of streaming services. And so everything has a cost. But for me, one of the things that I always figured was like the least carbon and sort of the least impactful on the world in some ways is just being together. And obviously you see this not always the case, because so often when you end up in places like big festivals and stuff like that, to manage that many people, they end up going with really disposable things. And so you do run into this problem where tons of people in one space create some logistical challenges in terms of trying to ensure that you're not overusing disposables. But really, to me, the hope for me would be that the place we could find real change and real joy within a low carbon world would be within these types of gatherings. And so music, to me, it makes a lot of sense in that way. And I'm curious what your sort of thoughts on that are, and also what you're sort of hoping to inspire with your work at the Junos.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you that we need moments of joy. I think music festivals are kind of like potentially, not always, revolutionary places of people just stepping outside of their regular life and like being in a collective with other people. And I think there's profound possibility in music festivals. And interestingly, Ian Garrett, who teaches at York University and runs the Center for Sustainable Practice in the Arts, we've done some work with them, told me, and he's done more analysis on this than I have, that if you have 1,000 people going to, say, Massey Hall for a show, assuming that those people are like not in their homes for those couple of hours, so their lights are turned out and they're not watching television, if they were to all take public transit or ride their bikes or walk to that music venue, there's a net gain because they're all together, they're not in their homes, so it's actually better for that period of time and drawing less energy. You know, even if we factor in like there may be some disposable stuff, it's still a net benefit. So the thing is how we get people to shows and to concerts, which really raises an interesting question, because the music industry doesn't control necessarily how much governments invest in public transit and in infrastructure. But they could potentially, and we're trying to leverage that them or us, the music sector, to actually advocate more, because there's been a lot of talk, especially in Toronto, around saving the nighttime economy. And what do we do? Well, cutting service and raising fares of public transit hurts the nighttime economy hugely, especially when you see Ubers doing surge pricing, etc. So a good, resilient, well-funded, reliable public transit system is actually good for the nighttime economy. It's good for live music. And when we bring people together, there's a sense of community. And there's also like, it actually is better for climate. So I think, you know, we're really experimenting with what can music venues or music festivals do besides obviously advocate for better investments. And we did something really interesting last month where CBC, who's the broadcaster for the Junos, had an event in Halifax called Road to the Junos. It was 5 nights, the same venue, different East Coast artists. And they invited us to activate and participate with them. So what we did is sent a communication to all ticket holders, encouraging them to take public transit, to walk or to cycle or carpool. And if they did, they could come and see Music Declares Emergency at our table, and only they could enter a ballot for a contest. And then at every intermission, I got up, I spoke about Music Declares Emergency, talked about our campaign, why we were doing it, and selected people to win free Junos wristbands or tickets to the concert on March 17th. And we had hundreds of people throughout the week fill in ballots. We had so many people tell us that it got them taking public transit for the first time since COVID or carpooling with their friends. And so it really like was quite impactful. It was a bit of an experiment. We've done similar tables before, but we've only communicated through social media, like more passively. But this was an active like what you need to know for this concert. Everyone got that email and it made a huge difference. So there are things that music venues can do around the transportation piece. And so that's why we're really emphasizing it in what we're doing for the Junos. But it's not like, well, we're just doing this for the Junos. We're trying to create structures and campaigns and ways of thinking that will live well beyond.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, and again, is the sort of thing that we need. Like, we need more people to start taking transit again. We need to shift the culture of moving towards transit. And I mean, as people have seen, the times transit is drastically the best way to leave a really big venue. You know, a couple weeks ago, there was a post about it was a long exposure or sorry, a time lapse of people leaving a concert, 50,000 people leaving a concert, and it's like going to the trains and getting on the train and coming out and then new people show up and then getting out. And it was just showing how many people use this in a short period of time. And it is undeniable, I think, that transit and walking and biking are so much better at moving large sums of people from places. Like every other time you try to do it, you try to drive out of the Sky Dome after a baseball game, for example, it's going to take you 3 hours to leave the parking garage. Yeah. And that's true about any number of these venues and any number of these places. And so, yeah, to me, that public transit piece is not only great for carbon emissions, but also for the experience. It's just so much easier and safer for everyone.
Yeah, and fun, right? Like you're high after a concert. You're like so excited and then you're with like on a subway car with like all these other fans of that music. I mean, and it, you know, this is a very big city, maybe focused way of thinking about it, but we've been like trying to find funding to experiment with music buses. So you think about like people come into Toronto from Guelph, from Waterloo, from Hamilton, from London, from Oshawa for shows, and they may take the GO train, but it might not go out to the suburbs in a time that's going to work for them. But what if you, and this goes back to the, like, we of course, people want to go see their favorite big megastars at the Scotiabank Arena or those big venues. But we need to be supporting the smaller artists and the mid-range artists, right? Because we sort of have a weird culture. If you look at most of the young artists who've made it big in the last 5 years, there many of them were actors or they're Nepo babies, right? Like you don't have a lot of people who are young, who are kind of grinding it out, playing a 100 cap show and then a 500 cap show or venue and then 1,000, kind of moving their way up. They kind of get propelled into superstardom. And then everybody else who isn't in that, you know, Olivia Rodrigo or Taylor Swift or Harry Styles level is suffering and hurting. So you have a small, I mean, kind of like endemic of like how late stage capitalism works in every sector, but you have this like less than 1% of musicians who are doing incredibly well and like becoming billionaires, right, from touring. And then you have the rest of the 99% of musicians who are struggling to make ends meet. And the only ones who can kind of sustain themselves are ones who come from incredible wealth or like families with huge connections in the entertainment industry. So how do we come up with systems that acknowledge that people are going to go see Harry Styles? And I'm going to go see Neil Young this summer, right? We're going to go see those big stars. But how do we support also more local music? So we want to do these buses. So like imagining people are going into Toronto to say see Neil Young, and there's enough people from Whitby, Oshawa, Bowmanville to fill a bus, and you figure out a way that you get them all in a bus together and it like picks them up and it's all Neil Young fans. But then you find an artist from that local area who's going to appeal to Neil Young fans. And they do little pop-up concerts, right? For all the people getting on that bus, they go on that bus, they get a free ticket to the concert, and you're exposing them, and you're then encouraging all those people to be like, hey, thanks for taking this bus. This is a really great climate initiative. This artist is going to do a concert in your area in a few weeks. You all need to get tickets and go see them, where you can ride your bike or walk to the venue. And don't only go to the big shows in downtown Toronto where you're paying hundreds of dollars. This guy's going to play for $20, right? And maybe they'll become the next big star and you're supporting. So like really trying to pair the work we're doing around climate with also trying to build a better local music culture.
And now we turn to Stefan speaking with Mitchell Beer of the Energy Mix about recent occurrences with the Doug Ford government, the Ontario Energy Board, and the carbon tax.
The story with the Ontario Energy Board was that in December, through much or most of the year, they had been holding hearings on how Enbridge, which is our gas supplier in Ontario, how they would set their rates over the next period. And the OEB ruled in December that Enbridge would have to charge households, charge developers who would then pass the cost on to households for the full cost of their gas hookups at the point when they hooked them up, as opposed to collecting that money over about a 40, I think it was a 40-year span, 20 or 30 or 40-year span. It's expensive. So the reason that matters is that spreading the cost over a longer period of time amounts to an incentive to install new gas infrastructure at a time when we know we can't have any more. You know, the sort of the popular name of the product is natural gas. Climate hawks like to call it fossil gas or methane gas. And the reality is that the primary component of natural gas is methane, which is 84 times more potent a climate pollutant than carbon dioxide over the 20-year span that matters most, because that's the time we have left to get climate change under control. So we can't be installing new gas pipelines. We can't be installing new gas distribution networks and hookups. And yet, because of the way their business is structured, and I can get more into this if you want me to, Enbridge basically has an imperative to keep on installing new infrastructure. They will start to lose money as soon as they can't do that anymore. And what the OEB was saying basically was the way you are going to price those new hookups will basically reflect the real cost of installing them in a way that makes gas less competitive against the things that we should be doing, like lots more energy efficiency, heat pumps, essentially electrifying everything, electrifying heating and cooling. And you know, whatever appliances we have in the home. Enbridge had every existential reason to oppose that, even if all the rest of us have every existential reason to be in favor of it. And literally within days, you know, you've got to pity the poor energy minister, Todd Smith. You know, he wasn't getting any early break for his holiday season here. Within days, he said that the province was going to introduce legislation, and they have since, to roll back this decision by the OEB. And what is astonishing and unprecedented and really disturbing to regulatory watchers in Ontario is that the Ontario Energy Board is independent. It's supposed to be politically independent. It's supposed to take no sides, play no favorites. And for a few of the stories that we've covered lately and in different contexts, I think we talked about the Sullivan North Pipeline a month or two ago in Ottawa, I've heard people say at least two or three times, this does not mean that I always agree with the OEB. It doesn't mean we won't publicly criticize the substance of a decision if we think it's flawed. We will do that. But we're not questioning their process. We get it that they're honest actors, honest players. And that is so fundamentally essential to, first of all, give us a better chance that a decision will go right, at least some of the time or more of the time, and fundamentally to be able to have trust in a system that is not rigged in any direction. So if you're in a situation where people can spend probably thousands or tens of thousands of hours on a hearing process, you know, and rip up some more trees for all the paperwork they have to generate through that proceeding, come to a conclusion that actually brings us toward a cleaner energy economy, a safer climate, more jobs, all of the things that the energy transition delivers, and they get it right, and a politically motivated minister can just rescind that, that's at a process level what we're hearing even more serious than the very serious mistake they're making on the substance. And yeah. As I say, I can, you know, if you have 5 hours or 5 minutes, I can get into why it is that Enbridge is doing this, because actually it's not just Enbridge, it's Fortis in BC. I've heard that it's the gas utilities in Alberta, and we've seen this elsewhere. It isn't that they're being evil in trying to continue to install gas infrastructure. Their fundamental job is to stay in business. And because of the way that, I'm not justifying it, but from their point, because this shouldn't be done, but from their point of view, their rule number one is to stay in business, because anything else they want to do depends on that. And the way those businesses are structured, they have to do this because they can only keep going if they keep on adding infrastructure. So that's the core of the problem, but this is where it's brought us, that we are corrupting an independent process in Ontario.
Yeah, and that seems like a pretty big problem. Big parts of the evaluation of oil companies is the futures and the idea that they are going to pump out oil for the next 20 years. The idea that something is that is so fundamental to our current infrastructure, like Enbridge is sort of simultaneously too big to fail and needs to continue to grow, else it will fail, does feel like we're locked in to this world, right? Like,
doesn't it though?
It makes you feel like the only answer would be to fundamentally change the system, because we know that trying to solve the problem will make Enbridge collapse. Yet Enbridge is providing, you know, gas right now to customers who need it for the time right being right now.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Yeah. How do we even begin to imagine an electrified world if even beginning to lay the foundations for that leads to such a overwhelming concern that we have to get rid of the arm's lengthness of an agency? Like, at that point, are we just running? Do we all work for Enbridge now? Are we just voting for Enbridge?
Let's have a look at their campaign donations. I have no idea what we'll find out, but I'm pretty sure it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
Whatever interesting means, let's get back, find out and get back to you. They're actually, this whole issue of getting from here to there, you know, we keep saying around here that we know the what. We know we need to decarbonize. We know we have the targets. We know we have the arguments in favor. We know in many places we have, you know, we have the programs in place, and some of them are pretty good. The how do we actually implement them? You know, after the years and decades that people have fought to get to this point, the how is actually even more complicated and has to get done fast and has to get done right. So yeah, that, you know, at the big picture, I think you've hit on one of the most, not the only, but one of the most fundamental challenges we have to grapple with and come out the other side. There is a story we're following, and we ran a first story on it this morning, and within a couple of hours of reader reaction, we knew that we were doing a follow-up because there was more to the story. The gas utility in Quebec, Énergir, hired, I would say, one of the best energy and climate strategy consultancies in the country to help them figure out how to get to real, not greenwashed, net zero. For a gas utility to try to do that, you know that the first cut's going to be imperfect, even if it comes from one of the best firms in the country. Because, as you're saying, there's no clean, 100% flawless way for them to get there. Some of what they're doing, like emphasizing energy efficiency, because once again, they make their money on the infrastructure, not the gas. Great. Absolutely. You know, if they can drastically drive efficiency, that's an incredible contribution. Some of the things they want to do, like renewable natural gas, will depend on where the gas is coming from. If it's biogas at a farm, you bet, absolutely. If it's, you know, some of the more greenwashed forms of at that point, so-called renewable natural gas, not so much. At the point when they say that they want to rely on carbon capture and storage, we've talked about that on the show, that, you know, the industry itself admits that the technology is not ready for prime time. So what I've been hearing, what we've been, our team have been hearing out and about, is that it's really interesting that NHL is trying this. It's definitely to their credit that they're trying it. It's probably no surprise that it's not going to be perfect. And the way you get to perfect is to try something and find out what's working and what's not and get some practice and then keep trying. So it's not to suggest that the NHL plan takes the gas industry where it needs to go in one bite. And as I say, check out our Heat and Power Digest probably next week, next Friday, because I, you know, we've just started in on the update that we've been inspired by our readers to take on. And I won't prejudge where that's going to go, but it's a really interesting story. And it's so different from what we're seeing with a company like Enbridge, even though they're facing the same challenges.
Because we are recording this a week early, it will be out the day this comes out. So right now. So one more story before we go to music break, which is connected to sort of the ways that climate action is being hampered in our country, which is a throwback to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago, but you have a new sort of update about it. The Liberal government's attempt to figure out how to talk about the price on carbon. Obviously, it's become a central point of the attack from Polyev. It's been mimicked by premiers, conservative premiers across the country. There is a significant set of action from people here using it as sort of their number one sort of thing to hit. Like, axe the tax has become the sort of the number one unifying message, it seems like, from conservatives across Canada. And that's a relatively profound problem for the Liberals and for climate action in generally, because for all of its failings, a price on carbon was one of the major goals that environmentalists had for a long time. And so can you tell us a little bit about the challenges that Ottawa is facing and what there is to be done about it?
It really has been a lightning rod, as you say, and it's really been a problem for them. And something that I have not been able to figure out and have not been able to get any answers on is how did we come to a place where the government sets up a carbon tax, carbon pricing system, where the large majority of households, including those in greatest need, get more money back than they pay out, you know, so that it's intended to not just be revenue neutral, but to be a gain for most households in Canada. How did they get to a point where people don't know that? How did they get to the point where they were not communicating that on bank and credit union statements from day one? How did they get to the point where when they tried to communicate it, the references were so vague that nobody knew what they were looking at? We're a house of two-person household of climate hawks, and we haven't a clue when our rebate is coming in. We know it's there, and we have confidence that it's real, and we're happy to see it. I could not point it out to you on a bank statement, maybe now, because they have finally, years and years in, and years after this communications nightmare has had a chance to entrench and metastasize, now they're finally communicating it. And what I don't get, and I'm not trying to inferentially lay blame, because I don't know where to lay it, but the people we see defending this in the news and defending it on the front line, they are very smart people, but many, most of them, but more to the point, they're skilled enough communicators to win a federal riding. Okay. And, you know, a comms person on a campaign can do a lot, but if your candidate can't string two words together or explain a concept, there's only so much you can do. Any communicators have ever worked on campaigns has been there and never wants to go back. That's not the case here when I look at the people who've been responsible for communicating this. So how is it that these just basic 101 mistakes were made? And I'm putting that in the passive tense because I don't know the answer to that. So that this problem came up. As it stands, the news reports we're seeing now say, no, the rebrand has failed. The rebrand is being mocked. And, you know, I can, you know, only agree with you that, yeah, axe the tax has become a bludgeon that one particular political party is using, even though some households, I was reading about this happening in Saskatchewan, are becoming alarmed about what will happen when that money isn't flowing back to them. So the message is maybe kind of starting to go out, but it really is late in the day for that to happen. One thing that I would like to see, and where I think this government or any government, if it wanted to, could do well politically by doing good for people and for the country. The axe the tax mantra took on so much more power in late October when the prime minister announced that they were suspending the carbon tax in the Atlantic, increasing the heat pump incentive, and specifically focusing their efforts on households that were still stuck with oil heating. It's the most expensive form of heating. These are very often the households with the least financial ability to change that without some form of backstop. And just by the way, oil heating is also the most carbon intensive way to heat your home. There might be others here and there, but you'd have to be really talented. So they were doing the right thing. They got slammed for it because, of course, it opened the door for opposition parties and opposition premiers to say, we now have a two-tiered, what do they call it? Two-tiered home heater, two-tiered tax system, however they put it. So the really obvious response to that is to say, okay, you know what? Strip away the rhetoric. Stop calling us names. And this is one we can actually agree on. What we need is a heat pump incentive for all households, for all geographies, and for all heating types, right? For low and moderate income households. Okay, so if you're in Alberta and you're heating with gas, and by the end of each month, you're choosing between food and fuel, you're in. We get that you're not in the Atlantic and that you're not on oil, but we're extending it, okay? Let's set out to get as far as we can down the road to making energy poverty history so that nobody ever again has to choose between food and fuel. And by the way, if I can articulate any of this, so can they. If it were rocket science, I wouldn't be able to. Now, with the budget coming up, what we have on April 16th, I think, what we have heard from the Minister of Energy and Natural Resources, Jonathan Wilkinson, is that the Greener Homes Energy Retrofit Grant, which has now been discontinued, is going to be replaced by a program that is specifically for low and moderate income households. And what we're hearing from the energy retrofit and energy auditing community, and we're talking about 75,000 jobs here, is yes, absolutely, set up a low income program. We've been begging and urging you to do this for years. Good on you. But don't cut back the program that everybody else needs, because at this point, we're getting energy retrofits done. We're getting buildings more efficient at about 1/10 the speed we need if we're going to decarbonize our buildings on time. So don't kill off this program that was so successful that it ran through all of its funding in 2.5 years that was meant to last for 7. Recapitalize it and put on the low-income program as well, low and moderate income, so that everyone hears the concept, everyone gets what they need, and along the way, we show some pretty impressive emission reductions. That ended up a bit of a journey, and thanks for being patient with it. It doesn't completely answer it about the carbon price, but what it does do is show Canadians, show households, show voters, show folks that we're actually getting something back for all of this rhetoric, and it's actually probably maybe pretty good for us. One of the people that I interviewed on the Greener Homes Grant, somebody who's just been doing this forever and just does brilliant work, was saying that this is one of the few or possibly the only program in the federal climate agenda that actually brings something back to households. So seriously, why would you kill that off? And that brings me back full circle to what brilliant communicators came up with this, and can we please get them working for the oil industry instead?
We are going to go to a music break, and we'll be back to talk about some good news stories that are happening, which will be a nice change.
It's not easy.